From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two men died in Portland, Oregon last weekend after trying to stop a man on an anti-Muslim rant. A week earlier, a black college senior in Maryland was stabbed to death by a member of an alt-right group. As extremist groups have become more strategic in their recruiting tactics, the number of hate groups in the U.S. has risen. So have the number of hate crimes. This hour on Point, the rise of hate in America. You can join us on air or online. Have you noticed an increase in hateful acts in your community? Do you feel you've been the target of hate? Would you know how to intervene if you've witnessed a hate crime? And what do you think is at the root of this? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Maxine Bernstein. She reports on crime, law enforcement, and the federal courts for the Oregonian, and she's been covering the Portland attack. Maxine, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Sasha.
So this happened on a light rail train, very crowded. I think it was standing room only. Tell us what happened on that train.
Well, a man boarded the train about 4:30 or shortly after 4. The train was, all the seats were full, witnesses tell me. There was standing room only, but it wasn't yet the full rush hour crowd. And as soon as this man boarded, he was shouting and yelling, verbal assaults, racial. He went on a racial tirade, and he was disparaging two teenage women who were seated, who were passengers on the train. One of the teenagers was African-American. Another was wearing the Muslim headdress, the hijab, and he was shouting remarks such as pay taxes, free speech or die. He was yelling to go back to Saudi Arabia. I don't care if you're ISIS. Go home. We need American here. And a lot of the other passengers were very disturbed by this. And three men during that brief ride between two stops on the train attempted to intervene. One man tried to talk this man, who was later identified as Jeremy Christian, just calm him down and talk to him and try to be a buffer between him and these two teenage girls. And in the course of that, it turned into the man who was on this tirade. He kept yelling. He wasn't quieting down. The train operator over the loudspeaker was urging whoever was involved in this disturbance that they needed to get off the train. And these three men who were just, you know, one was on his way home from work, another was heading to his job at a pizza shop, were attempting to get this man to leave. And in the course of that, the man just suddenly pulls a knife and stabbed each in the neck multiple times. And the one man who we learn is a city employee, 53-year-old city employee, an Army veteran, died from multiple stab wounds on the train at a stop. Medics attempted to, and other passengers who rushed from another car on the train rushed to his side to start immediate chest compressions, and then medics arrived but could not save him. Another 23-year-old man who is a recent Reed College graduate, you know, slashed multiple times in the neck as well, stumbled to the floor, and another passenger stayed with him, literally took the shirt off her back
to try to stop the bleeding. I read about this.
Yeah, and then held her hand on his and is praying with him, just trying to keep him calm until medics arrived. He was taken to a hospital, but later died at the hospital. And then the youngest victim, a 21-year-old man who was also stabbed. He got into sort of a little short, a shoving push match with the armed man before he was stabbed, and he stumbled off the train. Another like Iraqi veteran was there on the transit station and tried to calm him down, to keep him breathing, and he survived.
And he survived. In fact, he was at the arraignment of this man. We'll have a little tape from that later. Maxine, the Fox affiliate in Portland, KPTV, was able to interview the 16-year-old who was one of the two teenagers. She is not Muslim, but her friend is and was wearing a hijab. And here's what that 16-year-old said. Her name is Destiny Mangum.
He told us to go back to Saudi Arabia, and he told us that we shouldn't be here and to get out of his country. He was just telling us that we basically weren't anything and that we should just kill ourselves.
And Maxine Bernstein of the Oregonian, the person who's accused of stabbing these three men, John Jeremy Christian, is a known extremist. It seems that there's quite documented history of some fairly extremist behavior by him. Run through that with us.
Well, he has prominently shared and espoused his Nazi beliefs on social media. His Facebook page is filled with these rants that he called Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, quote, a true patriot in one of his Facebook postings. He also attended a rally in April and March. It was a march for free speech, and he brought a baseball bat. Police seized that bat. He was casting Nazi salutes while wearing a Revolutionary War era American flag wrapped around him, and he was shouting, "Die, Muslims!" He has felony, robbery, kidnapping, weapons convictions in his past as well.
We have some tape of Jeremy Christian in the courtroom when he was arraigned, yelling about patriotism as he was led away in handcuffs. Let's first listen to his shouting about free speech.
Free speech or die, Portland, you got no safe place. This is America. Get out if you don't like free speech.
Again, this is in the courtroom. And then again, as he was led out of the courtroom, this is when he was in handcuffs, he began some more of his tirades and he got a lot of boos from the hallway.
Death to the enemies of America. Leave this country if you hate our freedom. Death to Antifa. You call it terrorism, I call it patriotism. You hear me? Die.
Our listeners may have heard him say death to Antifa. That's a name by which groups are calling themselves anti-fascist. Maxine Bernstein, I want to bring in another voice. This is Camila Rashad. She is Muslim American. She's joining us from Philadelphia. Camila is a social justice advocate, and she was a founding member of Muslims Make It Plain. It's a grassroots group that has worked with Black Lives Matter to address police brutality and racial and religious profiling. Camila, thanks to you for joining On Point.
Thanks for having me, Shasta.
Could you give us your perspective on what happened in Portland?
Well, I first want to acknowledge that this incident actually happened on the first day of Ramadan. And it reminded me of 2 years ago that the Charleston massacre with Dylan Roof also happened on the first day of Ramadan. So there's a very tragic way in which, you know, the beginning of times that we find to be very sacred for us, you know, we're reminded that the violence here in the United States continues and across the globe, just most recently today in Kabul in Afghanistan. And so when this news started to break about what was happening and that these two men had been murdered and one seriously injured, it's frightening. And I think it's frightening because there have been other incidents, you know, not lethal, but have led up to this point. And so, you know, one of my first thoughts was, you know, someone unfortunately, you know, tragically has died, and we're now having a national conversation about the threat of white violence or white supremacist groups, extremist groups. But these aren't isolated events. And so there's, you know, a way in which many communities of color, many marginalized communities have been talking about the fear of, you know, the threat of violence, talking about how people have been verbally harassed in public, have been assaulted. And so when these things continue to happen unabated, and we have a president that doesn't you know, address this very explicitly, you know, as cause for concern, I think it sends a signal to many communities that even in public spaces, we're not safe.
Camila Rashad, in your view, are these types of incidents on the increase?
You know, I would say when I hear, you know, people refer to it as a rise in hate crimes, I would say it's a rise in our awareness, kind of our public collective awareness of hate crimes, because these incidents, unfortunately, have been happening, but they've been covered as sort of isolated events or something just on the extreme end, sort of outliers. But Saturday night, just one day after the Portland attack in Clear Lake, California, a white male by the name of Robert Anthony Hammonds was also arrested for stabbing a black man with a machete. And the police are saying this was also racially motivated. And so I think with an increasing awareness of how outspoken some of these groups have become and that this can turn lethal, I think is kind of long overdue. And
when you say increasing awareness, does that mean you don't think it's on the rise, simply we're more aware that it's happening?
Yes, I would say that the threat of those groups have been present. I think because of the sociopolitical climate, there's now a way in which free speech is being used to cloak some of these activities. I think, unfortunately, the lack of a very explicit denunciation of these groups by President Trump has also kind of emboldened some groups to be more overt. But that threat has been present. I think now those outside of those marginalized communities are now becoming more aware.
You mentioned free speech, and later this hour we will have someone from the ACLU who will weigh in on that issue, the free speech issue, and when we sometimes need to hear things we may not like to hear, but that's the system we've designed. Maxine Bernstein, reporter for The Oregonian, thank you for having been on today. It was good to have you on the show. And Camila Rashad, stay with us. Camila is with us from Philadelphia. She's a Muslim American and a founding member of a grassroots group called Muslims Make It Plain. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about hate crimes in the U.S. following fatal stabbing attacks in Oregon and Maryland. Join this conversation with us. Let us know if you've noticed a rise in hate crimes in your city or your community. Do you think hate has always been there, but we just haven't been paying close enough attention? Or was this always below the surface, and is it a new phenomenon? If so, what fuels it? With me from Philadelphia is Camila Rashad, a Muslim American who founded a group called, or founding member of a group called Muslims Make It Plain. It works with Black Lives Matter to address police brutality and racial and religious profiling. Camila was one of 14 American Muslim leaders invited to attend a roundtable discussion with President Obama in 2015. And joining me now via Skype from Bloomington, Indiana, is Janine Bell. She's a professor of law at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law. She's also a hate crime scholar, and she wrote Policing Hatred, Law Enforcement, Civil Rights, and Hate Crime. She's also experienced this personally. In February, an alt-right group posted a white supremacy flyer on Janine's office door and the door of other faculty members of color at Indiana University. Janine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Sasha.
I want to start us off with a piece of tape from the surviving man who tried to intercede in that Portland case. He ended up with a stab wound to the neck, some very serious injuries. And yesterday he talked to Portland's NBC affiliate, KGW-TV, about how he's coping.
I'm having a hard time just going outside. I got stabbed in the neck on my way to work, randomly, by a stranger I don't know, for trying to just be a nice person. Like, I don't know what to do after that, you know? I'm healing. That's what I'm doing. As much as I can.
That's Micah Fletcher. He's 21, again, survived a stab wound in Portland. And I want to read an interesting comment we got from a listener on Facebook. This is J.P. Frinks. He writes, "As a black person in America, every day I walk out of my house, I have to put on armor, and it's heavy. I walk into the world prepared to endure an onslaught of minor slights from my commute to my office to the place I choose for lunch and to face the possibility of becoming the victim of abhorrent violence. Jeanine Bell, before the break, we heard Camila Rashad talk about her belief that there's a rising of awareness about these. Can you tell us whether there actually is an increase as well based on the data you've seen?
I think there's actually been an increase in the number of hate crimes. The hate crimes are certainly underreported and have always been underreported. And there may be a slight rise in the number reported, but there's also, I think, a rise based on the data I've seen in the number that are actually happening. And this is very disturbing as a scholar of hate crimes.
Statistics gathered by the Southern Poverty Law Center certainly back that up. They say hate crimes have been steadily climbing for the past 30 years, but particularly over the past year or so. When you tell us, Jeanine Bell, that sometimes hate crimes are underreported, why is that?
Victims or targets of this violence may not know that it's actually a crime in particular jurisdictions to target you because of your racial background, your gender identity, your sexual orientation. They may also be used to sloughing off a number of incidents that are actually harassment because that's part of their daily life. So they're very complicated reasons for not reporting these incidents.
And on the law enforcement side, what is the advantage, assuming there is one, of labeling something a hate crime?
If you label an incident a hate crime, you increase the incentive for law enforcement officers to investigate it, to punish it. If there's a punishment for it, then there is a reason. The vast majority of low-level incidents, and by low-level I mean incidents that aren't murders or serious assaults, doesn't send the victim to the hospital, those incidents tend to be not investigated by the police, and hate crime label changes that.
We have a number of callers who want to weigh in. Let's hear from some of them. Justine is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Justine, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts as you hear this conversation.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me. As a preface, I want to say that this attack is obviously horrific, and all people should be treated with respect always, regardless of their race or their color, their ethnicity, their religion, etc. However, I think that the media is really stirring the pot. And I think that has to do with an increase in the reporting of these crimes. And I think it might also have to do with the increase of the incidence of these kinds of hate crimes. When a perpetrator or suspect in these attacks is white, the media automatically, you know, jumps on it and says, oh, he was a Trump supporter. He was, you know, this is the result of Trump's rhetoric and Trump's anti-immigration policies. And then later when that turns out to be not to be true, as in this case, the guy was actually not a Trump supporter, and he had disparaging things to say about all people, including Trump supporters, you know, the media sort of backs off and still covers it as a hate crime and lets everyone sort of continue assuming that the guy was a Trump supporter, et cetera. But when the perpetrator or suspect is a person of color or someone who is otherwise not white, the knee-jerk reaction by the media is that, you know, this person does not represent all Muslims or does not represent all African Americans or does not represent all Hillary supporters. And I just see that as, you know, maybe inviting these kinds of crimes because people want the attention or they see, you know, they see the media coverage that other people who have perpetrated these kinds of crimes are getting.
Do you think they should go uncovered? Do you think they should be uncovered or covered differently?
I think that it should be, yes, I think that it should be covered differently. I think that the media should not rush to assume that any white person committing a crime is part of a larger movement in the same way that any Muslim committing a crime in the United States is not automatically assumed by the media to be part of ISIS until, you know, I think people should be, the larger group should be innocent until proven guilty.
Justine, thanks for that. Camila Rashad, I'd like you to weigh in on that. You have said publicly you feel that hate groups have been emboldened recently and that you believe there's a Trump factor there. So comment on what we just heard from Justine.
Yes, I mean, I find that comment actually to be a bit disingenuous, because when there is a crime committed by someone who's Muslim American or non-white, there is an assumption of criminality of the entire community. Muslim Americans are called to make public statements to denounce the acts, and it is not the coverage, it's not the media. I think when these incidents happen, there is a tendency to talk about them as if they're isolated events. And I wanted to offer just one fact that a survey conducted by the Black Youth Project at the University of Chicago just last year in 2016 found that 62% of young African Americans and Latinos from 18 to 30, 62% of young Blacks said that they are more concerned about the threat of violence committed by white extremists than ISIS. 55% of those young Latinos said that they are also concerned about that threat of violence. So it is present, and there are many who are fearful now that it becomes a debate about free speech. It becomes a debate about this being deflected by quote unquote fake news. And so the truth that is being uncovered, like I said, there's a rise in kind of trying to understand the pattern of these incidents shouldn't be ignored. Of course, we don't indict every white Christian male. That didn't happen with Dylann Roof. It didn't happen with Craig Stephen Hicks, who murdered three college students in North Carolina in 2015. But I think there needs to be more attention paid to, one, the threat of violence is there, which often triggers an increase in traumatic stress and emotional anxiety in communities of color and faith communities, any marginalized community. So there's the stress of just the threat of that violence happening or escalating. And then there's those incidents, unfortunately, that are lethal, and we have people who are murdered. And so I think we should try not to just blame the news for the things that are happening, but really try to understand the root cause of this violence and what's fueling it.
Camila, let's go to another caller. This is James calling from Stratham, New Hampshire. James, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts as you hear Camila talk?
Yeah, hi there. I've been traveling around the country since President Bush started campaigning. I mean, President Trump started campaigning for the presidency. And I've seen in many countries, I mean, in many states, in Louisiana, in Jacksonville, in North Carolina, just on the day of Trump's presidency, I was staying at a Holiday Inn. I was sitting at the bar, just still in shock that the president was elected. And a Trump supporter beside him was very happy with his with Mr. Trump being the president. And we talked for a while. I congratulated him, kind of, you know, ate my dinner and was retiring to my room. In the meantime, he was going out for a cigarette, and there were some protests on the TV at the time, and he walked away and said, I'm not going to say it online, but hang, you know, the horrible term that you see all the time, the Black supporters, Black rioters on TV. I mean, I see it. I saw in Houma, Louisiana, a Trump supporter who was just excited to go come out and tell me how much he was a racist. I saw it in Jacksonville, Jacksonville at another hotel.
But you believe that you've seen an emboldening effect, the kind that Camila talks about.
Absolutely. Camila Richard, who mentioned it, he's emboldened he's opened a can of worms, and it's maddening. I cannot believe how much I see it. And I mean, I don't know if we should give up on these people. Look to their kids, and hopefully get some mandated education, and maybe get them to the new museum, the National Museum in D.C. to teach them this history and teach them how horrible it is.
James, thank you for that. Let's bring another caller in, this one from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and this is David. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I wanted to comment that during a very bombastic and racially filled hate campaign, I watched people that I had great respect for overtly on Facebook display insane racial attitudes that I would have never suspected from them, to the point where I literally shut down my Facebook account. It was so disheartening to me to see people that I thought were, you know, centered and good people. But I think that the campaign lended a voice to that, a legitimacy for them to then voice opinions that evidently they've held for a long time or that they just took on as their own. But it really has to be acknowledged that the campaign gave a legitimacy. When you have people like Steve Bannon in the White House, I think it gives a legitimacy to that attitude. And it's so, so disheartening to me.
David, thank you for that. Listeners, please weigh in if you feel differently, if you think that if you think there's less of a Trump effect than many of our callers have said, let us know. Jeanine Bell, professor of law at Indiana University, you've talked to us about how there appears to be a documented rise in hate crime-related incidents. Do you have a sense of why? Does the research tell us whether there may be a connection to current political politics?
There's very little research on why this is happening. We do know that there have been a rising number of hate groups, and this predated the election last fall, an increase in the number of hate groups. So that may be one of the reasons. Now, the increase in number of hate groups certainly has been documented. And moreover, they're feeling that there is now favor with the type of rhetoric they espouse in the current administration has been documented as well. They're quite clear when asked about how they feel about the current climate in Washington. They're quite clear that they have someone looking out for them. So that could be the reason for this.
The mayor of Portland, Ted Wheeler, does share that view. He's talked about the current political climate, which in his words allows far too much room for those who spread bigotry. Again, that's the Portland mayor. I want to play another piece of tape, this one from Wellesley, Massachusetts. This is a very well-to-do suburb of Boston, where about a year ago, there was a black student who had come to the U.S. from South Africa. Some of his classmates, or he ended up the victim of racial attacks on Facebook carried out by some local teenagers. And that student's father, Tendai Mushikavanu, had this to say on WBUR when he was asked whether the country's current political climate encouraged those students to use racially charged language.
Whether Trump or whether anybody else, these issues are bubbling beneath the surface. And all that's happening is some people are the pimple through which this pus comes out. The question then is, how do we address the issues, the underlying issues in our country?
Camila Rashad, your sense of whether the pus is always there, as that man put it, but sometimes it has a different or easier way to exit?
Yes, that's quite an analogy. But I agree. I think there, unfortunately, again, it takes sort of these very extreme, horrific events to kind of spark the conversation. But I think as one of the callers or someone mentioned on commented on Facebook, that living sort of with these daily microaggressions, the threat of the violence, the fact that it has been emboldened. I mean, if you watch clips of rallies, Trump rallies, and the things that those attendees at those rallies are shouting, it was very frightening. And so when those things are legitimized and to some extent normalized, we almost become desensitized to someone shouting a racial slur. And so in comparison to someone then being murdered on a train. And so we have these two, almost one very benign incident, you know, just shouting a slur. No one is physically hurt by this. To now these attacks in recent days, I think there's a sense of, well, this is probably just an isolated event. You know, something there's perhaps that person has a mental illness. We shouldn't, you know, feel that this is representative of some of the, you know, underlying climate in the country. But with the rise in hate groups, with the just the legitimacy that has been given to some of these groups and the things that they're espousing, we have to be very concerned that there is much more. It's almost kind of like the iceberg theory. There's much more beneath the surface that we really should be paying attention to.
That's Camila Rashad. She's been with us from Philadelphia. She's a Muslim American who is a founding member of Muslims Make It Plain, a grassroots group. She also was one of 14 American Muslim leaders invited to attend a roundtable discussion with President Obama in 2015. Thanks for having been with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the rise of hate in America and how free speech fits in. Join this conversation. Let us know whether you think two upcoming rallies in Portland, one that is intended to be anti-Muslim, one is that's being called the Trump free speech rallies, should be allowed to happen. Portland's mayor think they shouldn't. He's trying to block them. That's up in the air, whether they'll take place. Let us know if you think we simply have to hear things sometimes that we don't like, even if we think they're ugly. With us still via Skype from Bloomington, Indiana, is Janine Bell, a hate crime scholar and a professor of law at Indiana's Maurer University School of Law. And also joining us from Portland, Oregon, is Matt Dos Santos. He's legal director for the ACLU of Oregon. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Sasha.
We've been talking mostly about the Portland attack that happened last weekend, but shortly before that, there was another fatal attack, a white man on a black man. This was apparently an unprovoked attack at a bus stop. The student that died was Richard Collins III. In an interview with CBS Baltimore earlier this month, a black student at the University of Maryland spoke about how he felt on campus following the death of that student.
Definitely makes me nervous, and it makes me wonder what else is going on underneath the surroundings out here.
Matt Dos Santos of the ACLU, could you first give us your perspective on what you think has changed, if anything, and how is it changing in terms of the hate landscape?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, I think listening to your other guests was really instructive. I think the connection couldn't be more clear in my mind to some of the things that are happening around the country and the election of Donald Trump. During his campaign and subsequently in the White House, President Trump has embraced a racist, white nationalist platform. And the elevation of those ideas to the highest office of the land has emboldened people to act on racism and xenophobia more often and more publicly. But really, I think that's why it's so critically important that we as a community stand up to racism by engaging in protest and counter-protest and reject the hateful rhetoric or divisive politics that we're seeing coming out of Washington, D.C.
The two rallies I mentioned earlier are getting a lot of pushback in Portland. One would be a free speech rally. One would be an anti-Sharia law march. And on Monday, during a news conference, Oregon's mayor, Ted Wheeler, who's pushing back on this, explained why he wants the rallies canceled.
My main concern is that they are coming to peddle a message of hatred and of bigotry. And I'm reminded constantly that they have a First Amendment right to speak. But my pushback on that is that hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Matt Dos Santos of the ACLU, is that correct, that hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution?
Maybe unfortunately, that is not correct. There are a lot of countries around the world where hate speech is criminalized and not protected by their constitutions. But here in the United States, that statement is just plain wrong. And so it's really troubling for me to hear a public official get the law so wrong, because I think it leads to more confusion in the public about what is and isn't covered by the First Amendment and where the government can and cannot stop people from engaging in speech that is hurtful. And I think it's also clear, it's important to articulate that generally speaking, a person's First Amendment rights stop at a certain point, right? It's violence, these like so-called fighting words, when you're inciting violence, when there's an actual and imminent threat, or when you're engaging in some other criminal behavior while you're speaking. But unfortunately, hate speech is protected.
Matt, it sounds like from your earlier comments, you agree with the Portland mayor that there does seem to be a peddling of hatred and bigotry happening. On the other hand, you believe these rallies should be allowed to happen. Tell us why you think this sort of these anti-Muslim and pro-Trump free speech rallies should happen in Portland.
Well, sure. I mean, and I think there are two answers to that, right? There's the kind of there's the legal answer, which I want to get into. But I also want to start by saying, you know, I think in this moment, especially, it's so it feels like to me that it's our right and our responsibility as the public to engage in this dialogue and to reject these views. And at the ACLU, we often say this, and it sounds a little cliche, but I think it's important to say, which is that the best answer to this kind of speech is often more speech, and that can take all kinds of forms. And while it's a hard time for us here in Portland, we shouldn't be so quick to give up our rights, especially our First Amendment rights, in the hopes that the government will protect us down the road. We have seen repeatedly in the history of the United States and in the case law around the First Amendment that organizations like the NAACP are, in fact, often the targets of these laws. And, you know, it's clear we have a president in the office who, and his attorney general, frankly, who thinks that Black Lives Matter, a group that is, spreading, I think, a message of unity and trying to stop killings, they call that group a hate group. So when we put in the hands of the government the power to decide what is and what isn't hate speech and what is and shouldn't be censored, we take a big risk because I think that that can change with the political climate.
Let's hear from some more callers around the country. We have Marlene calling from Huron, South Dakota. Marlene, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha.
What do you think as you listen to this conversation?
Well, first of all, from listening to the whole conversation in the last 45 minutes, I'm beginning to think that you all think that I am a racist. And I am a Trump supporter. I am 60 years old. I'm female. I lived during the race riots of the 60s. And just listening to you people speak right now, it makes it sound like all Trump supporters are racists and haters. I think that if there's a protest that's anti-Sharia, it should go on. I'm not saying it should be anti-Muslim. I'm not anti-Muslim. I am anti-Sharia. Any ideology that goes against our Constitution and our democracy, we should speak up against it. We should not allow that. They should have to conform to our way of living in this country.
And when you hear data that says that hate incidents are on the rise, is there any explanation in your mind for why that might be?
Yeah, I do believe the media is guilty. Any sensationalism is gold to them. You do not hear all the good things that happen in this country among different races, unifying. I'm sorry for what happened in Portland. I'm sorry for what happens all over. I'm sorry when a black policeman gets shot by a black person or any kind of race. That should not happen. I feel like we had an administration that could have made things so much better in this country and didn't. We didn't have a president that spoke up against the hate crimes. I never heard him speak up against the hate crimes. And when it was just kind of pacifying.
If we separate out the media coverage of hate-related incidents, what do you think would be causing an increase in hate-related incidents?
The media fosters it. And so, listening here right now, you're saying at the Trump rallies, the Trump people are saying all kinds of derogatory things. They go and they protest and they're all derogatory. I have yet to have seen one where the Democrats weren't derogatory and hateful. And the media doesn't report both sides equally. Now, I have listened to South Dakota Public Broadcasting for 45 years since I've lived here. And I have gotten to the point where I don't like listening to it. Just Sunday, talking about President Trump at the Arlington Cemetery. It was Mr. Trump and President Obama. So there's an example right there where the media starts defining what's right and what's wrong.
Marlene, I'm going to bring another caller in. This is Sally calling from South Bend, Indiana. Sally, your thoughts as you hear this conversation, in particular our caller's view.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I do live in an area that's heavily Trump voters, Trump supporters, and I have to say I don't know any of them that are hate people or racist, and you don't know what's in someone's heart or what goes on behind closed doors, but it hasn't been my experience that they're that way at all. And I think there may be a rise in hate groups that think that's what Trump wants, but I don't believe that the majority of Trump supporters are that way or would support that in any way.
So the same question to you that I just put to our South Dakota caller.
Yes.
If there is there appears to be a documented increase in hate incidents, assuming you accept that, what do you think would be an explanation for why they would be on the increase?
You know, I don't know. I think identity politics is very divisive. I think that the left was really kind of pushing that ideology a lot, and I think that is a very divisive thing to do. I mean, we're all people. We should all be equal. We shouldn't be dividing people up into groups and genders and colors and, you know, make it something that's good for all of us while still supporting the minorities that need support. Another thing, too, if you just, I'm sure you notice it as well, on Facebook right before the election or right after, it was filled with hate from both sides equally. And I think, you know, that's very telling. Like, these people jump on a bandwagon on either side, and they can't even stop to listen to another person and why they might feel the way they do. And it's just gotten very ugly. And, you know, I don't think there's any one reason, but I think it's a very interesting time in politics based on the two candidates we ended up with.
To say the least. Yeah. Sally, thank you for that call. I want to go back to Jeanine Bell, professor of law at Indiana University, and Matt Dos Santos, the legal director of the ACLU of Oregon. In cases in which, we clearly, as we've talked about, have had cases in which there were apparently hate-motivated fatal stabbings in recent weeks. Can you talk about what bystanders are supposed to do? We had a case in Portland where three people stepped in. Two of them ended up being killed, one very injured. A listener on Twitter wrote a comment to us this morning saying, this is Keith MacArthur, "I've always thought I'd intervene if I witnessed an Islamophobic hate crime, but Portland has me having second thoughts." Jeanine Bell, do you have advice for listeners who might witness something and not be sure what to do?
Yes, you should absolutely try to contact the authorities in any way possible. If, for instance, on a train there is some sort of way to contact the conductor to describe an incident, to say that an individual is being threatened, those may be violations of the law. And individuals should absolutely alert someone.
What if there's no law enforcement around, or you're afraid that the delay could end up being fatal for the person being targeted?
I'd encourage them to interact with others around them, meaning gather a crowd, start condemning it as a group. And that, if the individual on the train had faced lots of people, then there might have been a different sort of outcome in that particular case. I don't think an individual should have to go into it alone.
Matt Dos Santos, there's an interesting story in the Boston Globe today about what bystanders could do. And it says one of the tactics is pretend you know the person being targeted or victimized. Just approach them and casually begin to talk to them, kind of put themselves, become a buffer of sorts between them and the person targeting them. What do you think about that kind of approach?
You know, I have to say that I am not a law enforcement authority, and I don't have a lot of experience in that kind of engagement and diffusion. I do think that it is worth saying that, you know, when we train our legal observers, right, we train them to keep themselves safe, to travel in pairs, to pair off, and to be in constant communication with each other. But I like that idea, right? The idea is that you're personalizing someone. And I think that it is much harder for a human being at a human level to engage in kind of hateful rhetoric or violence against another person, right? part of what's happening in the country right now is this profound othering of marginalized communities. And I think that that's what's leading to this sort of ability to kind of segregate in our mind who are people deserving of rights and respect and who aren't. And so I like that idea. I think it's a good one.
Another aspect of this, which I wish we had more time to talk about, is that apparently Ku Klux Klan chapters are on the decrease. So is the use of things like Nazi insignia. But what we see on the rise is a more subtle and what some people call intellectualized approach to trying to spread hate through things like setting up think tanks or nonprofits, or targeting college campuses where young people can be so influenceable, or operating in cyberspace or on social media where you can have much broader reach much more quickly. Jeanine Bell, do you see that kind of more insidious, more modern attempts to spread than just a KKK chapter?
Absolutely. I live on a college campus. I live among college students. There have been hate groups that have tried to reach out to college students and had websites recruiting college students with particular types of attitudes. You use one particular attitude for students on the left, one particular attitude for students on the right to try to get them to be part of these hate groups.
The expression alt-right, which we've heard so much in the past year, is to many people simply a rebranding of the term white supremacy. So in that perspective, some people think there's a public relations effort going on to take old ideas and give them modern names, although they may be equally insidious under either name.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The alt-right is just white supremacy.
Matt Dos Santos, briefly, any final word from you and parting advice on this issue?
Thanks for having us on. I think it's just fundamentally important that as we enter into these debates, that we do respect people's opinions on both sides, and that we call on our government to be circumspect and show restraint, in the face of some very unpopular opinions.
The mayor of Portland said something similar recently. This is Ted Wheeler. He said, all elected leaders in America, all people of good conscience, must work to deliberately change our political dialogue. Matt Dos Santos, legal director for the ACLU of Oregon, thank you for coming on the show. And also thank you, Jeanine Bell, professor of law at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law. We're glad both of you could be here for this hour.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.